This is Property Matters, a weekly catch-up on the world of property, supported by Fairview International Property Consultancy and auctionproperty.co.uk. We're live every Sunday from 10 a.m, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn and the website, propertymatterstv.co.uk. If you're watching on the website, please leave us a Google review. And if you're watching via social media, get involved in the comments section. We'd love to hear your views. And our email address for any topics you'd like us to discuss, hello@propertymatterstv.co.uk. If you don't have time to watch us live on the Sunday, you can get us on the move, of course, on a podcast every Monday, 10 a.m. from the podcast platforms you see there. And we're live every across the week, in fact, on Dilsay Radio as well. So let's say hi to Joe. Joe, welcome.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning, Paul. Good morning to all our viewers and listeners. Nice, bright, sunny day today, which makes a lovely change. No rain in the background.
Yeah, we're bringing back an old friend this morning, Joe, not least the Renters Reform Bill, which is coming back to the Commons. So everyone was wondering whether it had been kicked into the long grass. The reality is it's back for its report stage this coming 24th of April. And they've got a few amendments, which I thought we'd just talk through today. So, of course, what's been happening, as we discussed recently, was a lot of Tory landlords got involved looking at the detail in the bill and said, well, you know, that's not going to work for me and that's not going to work for us and all the rest of it. So basically, there's a number of recommendations which we'll go through one by one. The first one is accepting a proposal by the Cross-Party Housing Select Committee that when fixed-term tenancy agreements end, tenants be unable to give 2 months' notice to leave until they have been in the property for at least 4 months. The committee most noted that this will give landlords a legal certainty of at least 6 months' rent at the start of a tenancy. Protection should be in place, however, to ensure tenants can leave earlier than this where the property is not of decent standard or to protect those suffering from domestic abuse, for example. So landlords will be guaranteed at least 6 months' rent. You can't give your 2 months' notice after the first month unless there are problems with the property.
Yeah, I mean, look, really, is there a change there? Because the current AST, the assured short-hold tenancy, is a 12-month tenancy minimum with a break clause at 6 months, in which a tenant can give 1 month's notice and the landlord can give 2 months' notice. So really, it's just equaling what the landlord could probably do. To a large extent, it's really not a huge difference. I accept the fact that if there is an abuse, if abusive relationship, or some other reason that are not within the Section 21 remit, then yes, I suppose there could be a slight amendment to that bill. But in all honesty, it's a massive. It's almost like a sledgehammer to break a nut situation to try and do this. More about perhaps just adding something and appeasing it, but then really making a huge difference. Because even under the Section 21 notice now, the minimum period is 6 months. And if you give notice as a landlord 2 months because you want the property back, you are guaranteed to have your rent paid up to 6 months. And if the tenant gives a notice of a month in month five, for argument's sake, they're going to pay till the end of the tenancy anyway, which is month six. I'm not really quite sure what the agenda behind that small amendment is, but we'll wait and see.
The second point was reviewing the operation of the courts before ending the Section 21 for existing tenancies to ensure the justice system can cope with the increased workload. And we did talk about this concern that the courts were not set up to deal with all these extra cases coming through, and that they said they would come up with some kind of scheme that would make it work with an ombudsman, I seem to remember as well. So clearly they've had their say here and they've been heard, the MPs, because before Section 21 can be repealed, landlords must have confidence in their ability to regain possession under Section 8, especially in the case of rent arrears and antisocial behaviour. The biggest obstacle is the capacity in the courts. The Law Society has warned that without investment for housing legal aid and the courts, the bill will not achieve its aims and may lead to an increase in backlogs, and landlords and tenants alike will be unable to enforce their legal rights. So again, most people can see that the system isn't ready, and certainly not at the moment fit for purpose on that score. So at least they're going to have a review, and one hopes that it's a root and branch and sensible review, so that there is something man enough to cope when it comes to it.
I think if anything is going to kick it into the long grass, it'll be that point. The courts are just not fit for purpose at the moment. They got a huge backlog from the time of the pandemic. The reasons are also varied. Speaking to a number of letting agents over the period, they've sort of said that basically, they can't get the eviction dates. Some of the landlords can't get the eviction dates. If they get the eviction date, the bailiff's appointments are so far down the road that it's untrue. Recently, a client of mine has just managed to get the eviction date, but the eviction date, I mean, that was only like last Friday, is in on the 29th of August. So the tenant is theoretically in there for yet another 4 months at least, on the basis that they're not going to pay their rent, and they probably will end up trashing the property because they're going to get kicked out. And it just, it just becomes a long issue. So I think if anything's going to kick it out, that's probably what's going to kick it out. More than anything else, there is obviously lack of investment and people in the court system that allows them to do that. So they're trying to sort of bypass that by creating an ombudsman. And that ombudsman is going to be saying that I need chapter and verse of why you've got to this stage. And that it, one of those things is called communication. And the communication issue is that they've got to have written evidence with the both the tenant and the landlord having that discussion, or having an intermediary like a solicitor or so on, to be able to say that these are the valid reasons of why the landlord wants vacant possession and the tenant needs to go. If the ombudsman doesn't see it fit that those discussions have had, the chances are the ombudsman is likely not to make a decision and then push that back into the court system. So I think if there's anything that is going to cause a problem for this bill to be actually passed, it's probably going to be there. So I think the first one is a bit of a red herring. So, we could add a couple of things to the bill. The second one is probably more reason why it will probably get thrown out into the long grass. And personally, I feel that a lot of these changes are being made for the sake of changing and changes. And certainly, a lot of landlords have been pushed out of that particular market because they just don't want to be part of this new circus.
The final point, really, on all of this is ensuring all types of student housing, including 1 and 2 bedroom properties, are covered by the planned ground for possession to protect the annual cycle of the student housing market. This is supported by the Labour-led Local Government Association, which noted that it would give confidence to student landlords who rent properties not considered as HMOs that they can offer properties each academic year. Presumably, this is the right to, at the end of the school year, have them leave and then have the tenancy available for somebody else. Is that the gist of that one? I'm not quite sure what
Yeah, but
that one's all about, if I'm honest.
it's absolutely the gist of that. But to be honest with you, what is the gist of that? I mean, most students are going to be gone within a 3 year period, from their university accommodation. And if they are, not treating the place properly, then of course I fully understand that the landlord wants them evicted and creates a problem on the one they want to rent in the future. But having both of us have had kids go through university, I don't think that any of them are at that point. They're, I mean, more concerned about making sure that they get their deposit and their return of their bits back than to start thinking, well, I'll stay here longer than I need to. It's a cycle. But again, I think it's probably a bit of a sledgehammer, really, to do something that it's the old adage of what's not broke to fix. What do they say? To fix something that's not broke. Yeah, but I
Yeah,
don't think
if it
it's
ain't
actually
broke, don't
broken.
fix it.
Yeah, I just don't think that there's anything that needs, fixing there. I think the biggest issue in this whole thing is going to be about point two, and that is that they've got a lot to do before they can actually start to throw that into the courts and so forth. And that's only because there's a backlog, a huge backlog from possessions that could have happened or should have happened over a period of the pandemic. More than anything else, it's now lots of the reasons that they're using, Paul. What's frightful is that people are using, and some are genuine. I'm not going to say they're not genuine, but some are not so genuine. Are things like the word mental health now comes into it because it's an area that nobody really knew much about it. So all of a sudden, the court uses that and says, well, you know, if that's the case, we can't really add that burden on the state, so you're going to have to stay where you are. So the landlord is still lumbered with that situation, what that, you know, confines or whatever that, however that is used, is down to the individual. And that's where courts are having a problem, and that's where the ombudsman will have a problem.
The National Residential Landlords Association, or NALA, have been involved in this, of course. They say their focus has been on ensuring that when Section 21 repossessions ends, the replacement system works and is fair to both tenants and responsible landlords. Tenants should rightly be empowered to hold rogue and criminal landlords to account, to root out the minority who bring the sector into disrepute. However, it's also vital that the majority of responsible landlords have confidence in the bill to provide the homes for rent the country needs. And in their view, the amendments proposed by the government strikes the balance, and they're urging the MPs to vote for it this week. So it could well become law now, but with these changes by the end of this parliament. So it'll be interesting to see how the root and branch review of the courts goes on. And I'm wondering whether they'll actually manage to get that done within this parliament, because surely they can't go ahead until they've done that.
No, they can't go ahead until they've done that. And they've got a lot to pack in for other things in this parliament, not least a general election that is going to happen. So, you know, whether this gets, you know, a hearing from the Conservative avenue and then gets completely kiboshed if the Reds are successful after the general election, I think we'll find that this will be a subject that will probably come back to us time and time again until it actually gets home and dry. But I've always believed personally that it's, you know, not something that's necessary. There are some small amendments that should be considered, and they could probably do that as a Section 21A if they really wanted to. But to actually make the whole changes is probably a challenge that they're going to have, certainly, I think, in this parliament.
I was talking to someone, I'm going to put you on the spot now. I was talking to someone the other day who's a landlord, and she has a tenant, a long-term tenant that's been in there. She's been pretty good all the way through. She's paying £1,000 a month, and the landlord holds a £1,000 deposit, and her costs on that property in total come to about £550 per month. So she's pocketing £450 per month as you know, as profit, if you like, from that situation. It's got to a point where, for various reasons, the tenant is no longer able to afford the £1,000 a month. She's 2 months behind, and they've had a meeting, and she said, I promised to pay you, because she's got the £1,000 deposit, so she's got one of those 2 months covered with a deposit, obviously. And the tenant said, look, I'm not going to run away without giving you the other £1,000. So basically, she should come out of it at quits, really. But her question then is, what should I do, and what would you do, is a question to you, Joe, is what would you do? Because she's saying, do you know what, I really, with all this going on with renters reform and everything else, I really don't know whether I even want to go and find another tenant and risk the chance of that tenant being, you know, a problem, whereas this one's been really good all these years. She definitely have to go. She can't afford it. She's been getting behind, and gradually more and more behind. So it's clear that that relationship has to go. But she's thinking of selling. What would you do, out of interest?
Well, two things. In the current circumstances, you've got Section 21, which is obviously based on the fact that it is available to evict or give notice of 2 months by the landlords to say that they can go. There is a Section 8, which we referred to just a while ago, which is the reason based on rent arrears or, you know, not being a good tenant in any form. So a lot of those will have fallen into Section 8 service on the basis that she has fallen behind. The problem she will have if it goes to court is basically, you know, in the short term, if she is going to make the payments and she will bring it up, the court will give the tenant longevity. So my suggestion would be that communicate with the tenant, get as much as you can, and almost get the tenant to give you the notice to say that they're going to go in a month's time because they can't continue to afford to buy that. If you defend it yourself as a landlord, you're probably going to put up a bit of a barrier And somebody will advise that tenant that you don't have to go. If you can't afford it, go to the court. The court will actually stand in your corner and say, give her time. And so you might be in that relationship, perhaps a soured relationship with the tenant for the next six, maybe 12 months. So my advice would be to communicate with the tenant, get reality from them, get some extra payment. If she's making a profit, even if it's a couple of hundred pounds towards, so from £1,000, and she can reduce it to help her by, you know, to £800 and give her a bit longer period per month to try and get that money paid. Yeah, that will be very key in the future fight, if there is a fight, because then when you do go to court, the court will turn around and say, well, how did you come to this point? And the landlord can at least say, I made concerted effort to make sure that I work with this tenant because I wanted to help, but it come to a point where it just now was not financially feasible for me to continue to support this person and for them to continue to stay in there. The answer to part two of that probably is, do I sell or do I keep? Well, you know, throughout the experience of all of these lives, there are always going to be tenant situations. If you're in that business of landlord and tenant, you are going to likely to find yourself in that question more times than you think. For example, this has been a good tenancy for her and she wants to help her, and she is helping her to try and get her back on an even keel. Yes, you could get a new tenant by, you know, evicting this one and find that you've actually got yourself a worse situation, that the next one says they can afford it, and then find that you're now 2, 3, 4, 5 months in arrears. So my advice would be to communicate, make sure that you document it, understand where it's going to go in order to get your possession. No guarantee that the next tenant's going to be any better or is going to be better or is going to be any worse. And that's a gamble you'll have to take. If you then decide that you want to just sell and get out of it, of course, what you have to bear in mind is what you bought it for to what you're going to sell it at. And if it's a buy-to-let investment, you are liable for capital gains tax. So, you know, you might be making a regular £400 and you might end up paying 28, I think now 26% capital gains on the profit that you make on the sale, and ask yourself in calculation, is that actually worth me getting out? So hopefully that helps you answer some of those questions. And thank you for putting me on the spot.
Yeah, pleasure. I knew you'd cope. So let's just stay with tenancies and landlords for a minute, because story number two is no real surprise, but here's the evidence on paper. Tenants are looking to stay in their existing rental properties for longer as they look to avoid higher rents elsewhere, says new research. The average tenancy length in England and Wales has increased by, get this, 218 days during the last 4 years. This is according to research from the Deposit Protection Service. Renters are typically staying in their properties for a third longer compared with 4 years ago. The UK's largest protector of deposits has confirmed that the average tenancy now lasts 924 days, or just over 2.5 years, compared with 760 days, or just under 2 years in 2020. The organisation said the increase of 218 days amounted to just over 30% during the period. And here's the actual figures on the screen. So you can see in 2020, the average tenancy was 706 days. Then it rose to 783 during lockdown. 817 was the big jump. 863 last year, and now 924. And this is obviously, I suppose, Joe, a situation where people are thinking, well, two things. Firstly, I want to move, but I'm just not getting the opportunity because there's so much competition for each and every rental, and therefore, you know, they're getting either gazumped or they're just not quick enough to get to the agent in time. Or secondly, do you know what? My rent's pretty reasonable. Everything else that I'm seeing around here is a lot more. I might as well stick where I am.
Yes, both of those reasons are very valid. So the number one reason, of course, is all of this data came available during the time of the pandemic. So longevity came during that period. It was really difficult to shift and move to other places. So the data would show that people were staying much longer. Part two of that would be that they are staying longer primarily because to find another property, another rentable home that they want within the same area or within reach financially is becoming more challenging for them. So subsequently, it's better to stay where you are perhaps longer and try and work. Works both ways for tenants and for landlords. Landlords particularly don't really want to have a void period, though there's an attraction of a higher rent. Let's say, you know, one of them was paying £1,200 and now it should be £1,400, £1,500. The question is that if you were then vacant for a month, you've lost that potential gain anyway. So that void period becomes very expensive. So tenants and landlords, if they communicate again with each other, they may find that, you know, the tenant might pay another £100 and carry on staying. And the landlord's probably better off to keep that tenant as opposed to trying to find a new tenant. The third thing is, of course, calculation. When they're now renting property, their income is calculated in order to justify whether they can afford that rent that they're already paying. And you might find that it's actually worse than it is. So you might have got yourself a very nice, you know, 1, 2, 3 bedroom property at a given rent, and now you can negotiate highly with the with the landlord. But if you were to come out into the market, your next job is going to be able to justify whether your income is sufficient to support the next rent. Now, that rent might only be another £200 a month, but your affordability calculator may say that you cannot now no longer afford that. So, you know, it's, you could be jumping out the frying pan into the fire situation, rather than sort of making it. So the longevity is coming in the time on the basis of a number of things that people want to look at.
There's some interesting detail in these figures. The proportion of respondents who said that they'd had to take an additional job to secure their rental property, i.e. the increased rent, had risen from 27% to 30%. So there's a third of people between March and September 23 that were surveyed, and they'd had to take a second job just to afford the current rent or the rent in their new property, either way, which is surprisingly high.
Well, again, as I said, you know, if they were to come out and re-look at another property, their income on their existing may not be sufficient to support their affordability, which is why they're having to take second and third jobs in order to justify that. So while you're in it, it's better to try and get that second or third job and carry on paying or negotiate maybe a little bit more to see that the landlord is happy as much as. And most landlords are not, you know, they're quite happy with someone that is, you know, good, regular, and you know, trustworthy, and is looking after their property. And in the grand scheme, you know, another £100 a month is probably not going to be the breaking point. The point really is about when things don't work out well and they're not good tenants. That's when this communication breaks down and they'd rather have them out. And the other biggest problem is that the mortgage rate was, you know, just shot up over the last year to stupid amounts of money by comparison to what we were used. We all probably knew that it was going to happen, but I guess nobody's ever prepared for it. So, you know, the base rate of 5.25% then pushes their mortgage rate up. So if you had a hypothetical, if you had a £200 a month mortgage, it now become £600 or £700 a month. And that then makes you want to talk to the tenant and say, well, you're going to have to pay a little bit more towards this. So I think that, you know, if you have a communication with the tenant, the chances are both will come to a reasonable compromise. Of course, if it's a tenant that you'd rather not have, then of course you'll take all the steps to make sure that they leave.
And the proportion of respondents who'd had to pay £501 or more in rent to secure their rental increased from 5% from 8% during March to September to 13%. So obviously that, I presume that's not the that's in addition to the deposit, isn't it? The proportion of respondents who had paid £501 or more in rent to secure their rental. So that presumably means they're paying rent in advance as well.
Yeah, it's not about the deposit. I mean, the deposit theoretically is now calculated 5 weeks of the value. So if you are going to rent for 12 months, 5 weeks of that is what is held as deposit. So that's not a secret calculation. the actual rent value is the value that they've got to take into account on a monthly basis. So if you're looking at a rental of £1,000 a month, the chances are that that rent's now closer to £1,300 a month, you know, 1,250, £1,300 a month. So that's the bit that starts to, you know, hurt, and that's the bit that basically both the landlord and the tenant need to sort of come to an agreement with. The tenant, of course, needs to understand that they can afford it. If it means that they're taking a second job to cover that, then that's what they've got to do. The landlord has got to make a decision to say, well, do I kick them out for the gain of another 100, £200 and find that I've actually got a place empty, perhaps for a month, maybe 8 weeks, before it goes? And also, when it does become vacant, what they've got to do is they've got to bring it up to scratch due to the new regulations, meeting perhaps things like potentially a minimum EPC standard of C, in order to make sure that all of those other things. So that might mean that the landlord is now going to end up doing more work, let's say hypothetically spending another £10,000 to bring it up to scratch. So the question you really have to ask yourself is, you know, is it worth arguing about that 100, £150 as opposed to having to then found another £10,000 between £5,000 and £10,000 to bring it up to scratch. So there's a lot to be practical about and think logically about. But sometimes rational decisions are made on emotions, and they're made on the basis that they like the tenant, so he's got to go or she's got to go.
Final story. It's a little bit lighter relief than the previous two, you'll be pleased to hear. Britain's most expensive street has an average 9.6 million price tag, apparently. This is Buckingham Gate in Westminster. It's been revealed as the most expensive street in the UK. The average asking price, 9,633,333 quid. Taking second and third place for the streets with the average highest property price tag were Vicarage Gate in Holland Park and Park Road in St John's Wood, which have an average purchase price of 6.3 million and 5.8 million respectively. The analysis was by Rightmove, and they ranked the most expensive streets in the UK, the top five of which all fell, not surprisingly, inside London boroughs. Excuse me. Outside of London, Old Avenue in Weybridge is currently the most expensive street to buy on, with an average asking price of 2.633 million. The Ridgeway in Potters Bar, Hertfordshire, came second with an average price tag of 2.289, while Manor Road in Chigwell in Essex came third, costing an average of 2.2 million. Despite the eye-watering cost, sales searches for prestigious London boroughs are up. Searches are up 35% for those sort of properties, especially in Mayfair and St John's Wood and Holland Park. So it seems a lot of us do a lot of navel gazing and dreaming when we're looking on Rightmove. We're sitting there looking at these fantastic properties. Interestingly, I did have a look at Manor Road in Chigwell. It just reminded me of Birds of a Feather, you know, the TV show with the two girls back in the day. A typical sort of 1930s detached house that's been extended in every direction with five cars on the drive. Cannot believe that it's got to be worth that with a very busy road out the front. But then I suppose there's so much space that that's why the price is calculated and what it is.
Yes, it's always interesting when these analyses are made on why and how certain places become the most expensive properties or the places to live in. Of course, as you rightly say, most of it is in so most of the London boroughs. And so usually it's always about communication. It's about how they have the ability to have perhaps an underground station or road links or facilities, shopping facilities. Education, schooling is very, very paramount in these sort of discussions. And the type of properties, and of course the neighborhood. So Buckingham Gate, you know, you are living next door to King Charles's pad at Buckingham Palace. So, you know, it is likely that they perhaps want to be a neighbor of Camilla and Charlie. And that could be the reason why they're paying an exorbitant £9 million on the average for a property in Buckingham Gate. Nice area, by the way, Buckingham Gate. It's not bad at all. But I still think Mayfair and Belgravia probably are much, much better. But it's a busy road. And busy road takes you to your navel search of Manor Road. And thinking that, I'm looking at something like Manor Road, and why is that so expensive? And that's again a very busy road, but some parts of Manor Road has outlook at the back, outreaching over undulating fields and so forth, and farms. And I think people just get lost in the idea of sitting there in the garden and thinking, well, I have got no views being disturbed over. So that's but a very, very busy road. And yes, things like three-bedroom semi-detached properties over the years have been bought next door and then turned them into detached, providing access for and parking facilities for the big G-wagons that people like to possess in such areas, and so forth. So you've got to create space for those lovely Lamborghinis, Ferraris, and so forth that there. So I think it's really about, I mean, the main thing is about communication. In my book, curb appeal has to be the most powerful part. It's good to have all the other bits, but if something is not attractive, the road is not attractive, or the outlook is not attractive, then there's a reason why people will say, well, actually, I don't want to live here. And rightly so, Paul, as you've done your research on something like Manor Road, you can see it from Google Earth to see that, why would somebody want to be here? But there are other reasons, and those reasons are communication, like transport, underground stations, education, schooling. All of those things are the things that bring the values of those properties to such levels.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because just down the road is, I think it's Grange Road Station, which is on effectively the same road. You don't have to really go very far to get to a station. So you're absolutely right. If you thought that you would rent your way into the most expensive parts of Britain, because that would be cheaper, you've got another thing coming, because Albion Street in Bayswater properties there are going for £20,857 per calendar month. Say, I have to say, always makes me laugh that. This is followed by Pavilion Road in Knightsbridge, where you can rent a property for £15,251 per month. Duke Street in Mayfair has taken third spot as the most expensive street to rent, where you can expect to pay £14,441 per month. Outside of London, the most expensive street is London Road in Ascot, which has a rented value of £6,831 per month. Manor Road in Chigwell's back again, with the second most expensive street to rent, £4,300 a month it will cost you to live there. Dean's Kate in Manchester comes closely behind, where you'll pay £3,766 per month. Crazy, isn't it, when you think about it? £20,851.57 in Bayswater. For some people, that's an annual salary, let alone a monthly rent.
That's right. And is it any wonder that the first-time buyers are going to be struggling to get onto the first rung of the ladder when there are rental values at 20,000 a month plus around Bayswater, Mayfair, London, Knightsbridge, and so forth. Of course, they are key locations for many reasons, not just about the underground facilities and all the other stuff, but more than anything else, it's about the where all the key workers are, the big firms are, and of course you're surrounded by places like Hyde Park, Regent's Park, and so forth. So the outlook is, desirable, and of course, just put your headphones on and go running. That's the price you pay.
Just to bring you up to speed, and you're not aware of this shit because I only found this out myself yesterday, but for those of you who are watching our show on a regular basis in the property group that Joe runs, this is the last week you'll be able to watch the live video in the group, not because of anything we've done, but Facebook has decided in its infinite wisdom that you can no longer live stream into groups as of tomorrow, Monday the 22nd. So this will be the last time, excuse me, you'll be able to see us in there, but I am investigating a workaround so we can find out how we can maybe get it back in there for you. But in the meantime, you can still go to any of our pages, so the Fairview International page or the Property Matters Facebook page as opposed to the group. Or you can, of course, go to the website as well, propertymatterstv.co.uk, and you'll still find us there every week as normal. So that's just a heads up. If you're in the group, you're going to not find us there next Sunday, so find us on any one of the other places where we hang out on the weekend. Okay, lovely. Thanks, Joe, for your wisdom as always. We'll see you again for another Property Matters very soon.